All right, so we are studying the book of Esther. And really, it is a study of Esther herself, but we're just taking a look at the book. And there are actually co-stars in this book. Mordecai, of course, also plays a very important role, and we can learn from him as well as from Esther. And so we look forward to the practical lessons that we'll learn from him. But last week, we started in chapter 1 looking at the king. Xerxes is the king of Persia at this time. Ahasuerus is what he is called in the most of our translations. The name that he goes by in the Bible, but generally is referred to as Xerxes. And so a powerful king, a powerful kingdom, the Persian Empire at this time, and yet he's powerful only because of the authority that he has. There's a whole lot of ways in which he's just a weak man. And we saw that on last week. He's not a very good king. He likes to celebrate and do those kind of things, and constantly throwing feasts or banquets for the people, more so than getting down to the business of ruling as king. He also has a streak of revenge. He is planning to attack the Greeks. He wants to take revenge for his father, because his father was defeated by them, particularly the Athenians. And so he's planning to go to war. And that's what the feast in chapter 1, if you weren't here last week, we find that he threw a feast for 6 months, that lasted for 6 months, and got all the army, the nobles, everyone involved in the feast, and then had another little feast for 5 days in which everybody drank to as much as they wanted to, just like the king. They all got drunk and whatnot. And that's the time when he, in his drunken state, ordered for Vashti, the queen, to come out and to show her beauty to all those drunken men at the feast. And she refused. And that led, of course, to her expulsion from being queen. Then when we get to chapter 2, remember, between chapter 1 and chapter 2, there's a 4-year period of time that elapsed. And he actually goes on this campaign against Greece, and he's completely humiliated. He had a superior army, and yet they were soundly defeated. And so it was an undeniable defeat for him. He was humiliated. He was mad and angry. He goes back home, and as he's there, most scholars believe in verse 1, it says, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And most believe that that's indicating that he's kind of had a change of heart. He's back home. He, again, has been humiliated. He's sad, depressed because of the great defeat that he experienced. And he starts to think about his old queen. And I have a little quote here from Josephus. He talks about this section, this period of his life. It says, again, the Jewish historian Josephus, "Now, although the king was in love with her," that is Vashti, "and could not bear the separation, he could not, because of the law, be reconciled to her. And so he continued to grieve at not being able to obtain his desire." And that's from Josephus. And so that is basically the common view of most scholars, most commentaries, that's why Vashti comes up again here at verse 1 of chapter 2. He gets back home and he has his harem and, you know, hundreds of women, but there's a difference between lust and love, and he misses his queen. Well, we saw last week that his advisors came up with this plan. You just send out couriers to every part of the various provinces, and you get all of the most beautiful young virgins and bring them back, and then you choose from them, you find a replacement for Vashti. And he went along with that. And I don't know that we closed last week with that, I think, talking about, I don't know that we can emphasize enough or even properly just what a male chauvinist kind of king he was, and just the mistreatment and abuse of women at that throughout this kingdom and really throughout the world at that particular time. And it is a sad commentary on man that all through the years that has continued, not to the extent that we're seeing here. Like, this was just a terrible situation every way that you think about it. The king sending men out not to ask if young women would like to come and perhaps have a chance to be queen, but for all practical purposes, kidnap them from home, force them to leave, and come to be a part of the king's harem. Now you just think there has been a wide range of opinions about how many women he got in during this time. It ranges all the way from 400 to 1400. And it's probably closer to 400. But literally hundreds of women he would have gathered throughout all of the empire, and only one of them would be queen. So all the rest of them would be destined to a life in his harem, and it would be a lonely existence. You would never have, they would never have children or be married in the way that they would like. They would end up basically being his concubines. And so it was just a terrible situation. They had a custom basically at that time where the king would have three, within the palace, three houses for women. You would have the house that would house the young virgins. Then you'd have a house of concubines that once he had a sexual encounter with a woman, they would leave the house of the virgins and then be relegated to the house of the concubines. And there you would be for the rest of your life, or at least later stages in life. And the only time if he thought about you, if you pleased him, then he might call you by name and you'd come back. Other than that, after the one night encounter that you were forced to have with the king, you then would go back to the house of the concubines, and again, that would just be your life. And that's why a lot of people, it's been suggested that it would have been the case throughout the empire that people would lie, the fathers would lie about having daughters who were virgins and, or even having daughters or marry them off very quickly, before they could be snatched away. And some have suggested that even Mordecai would have tried to hide Esther. And because, I mean, it was just a terrible thing. And again, just one of all of these women, just one would end up being a queen. The rest of them would have this lonely existence that they were forced into by the king. And nobody thought anything of it. When the wise men suggested this, he right away, you know, it pleased him. Yeah, let's do that. And there's evidence in the text here that we'll see that he kind of made a tradition of that. That he continued, even after he's married to Esther, to have this calling of young virgins. And so that was just life for women. And, you know, I've said many times, I do not support and even despise with all of my being the feminist movement and all that it represents. But it would have to be admitted that all of that was caused because, for the most part, of women being abused by men all through the years all over the world. And, you know, it's kind of like atheism. I despise atheism, but the fact of the matter is most of the most famous atheists who in history that we know of came, they were very religious at one time. They came out of some denominational church. A lot of them had fathers who were so-called pastors, whatever. They would see the hypocrisy. They would listen to the false teaching that didn't make any sense to them. And before you know it, they're these atheists that have a lot of power and clout and whatnot. But it all came about because of false doctrine, false teachings, and that sort of thing. Well, feminism is I'm not going to say that it's all attributed to that. But, and of course, it has gone way in the other direction to ignore God's arrangement of things. But nevertheless, it all came about because of the abuse of women. So what's the, as we read a story like Esther and we see the background to it, that, you know, what we should learn, particularly those of us who are men as Christians, we understand that women are not simply objects. They are to be treated with value and worth because they're created in the image of God, just like all of us. We're all created in the image of God. They have the same worth and value as men, and that's the way they ought to be treated. And if anybody knows that, it ought to be Christians. And so we shouldn't have. Sadly, even today, even in this country, it continues. Not like we're reading in the book of Esther and around the world, but women still are degraded and viewed as objects and so on. And so we can learn, certainly as Christians, not to do that. All right, well, getting down into this text then, we see all of this happening. The king agrees with this decree that he ought to do that, and so he does. We get down to verse 5, and it says, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. And now, when you read that, it sounds like that he's talking about Mordecai there when he says that he had been carried away with Jeconiah. That would have been the second deportation of the Jews, somewhere about 597, I believe it is, or so. But that's not talking about Mordecai. It's talking about Kish. It doesn't read like that, but we know it is. Because just the timing, the chronology of it, if that was talking about Mordecai, he would have been well over 100 years old and near death. And that's not the description we have of him in the book. So that's just not to word it in our English translations the way probably it should be, but that's talking about Kish there. And so it says about Mordecai, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. So we right away find out something about Esther that usually it's what is emphasized, but it shouldn't be overemphasized, even though her beauty, it appears, was almost unmatched. And again, in the ESV, you see how it emphasized that. A young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And in the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, it says that Esther was one of the four most beautiful women in the world. That's the Talmud. Now, the Jewish collection of authoritative writings. But that's how they viewed Esther. How they came to that conclusion, I don't know. But you just think about, she in beauty stands out. They have gotten all of the most beautiful women throughout the empire, and we'll find she stands out from all of them. And so we're talking about a woman who is beautiful. You know, beauty sometimes can be a curse, can't it? Like, how many of these women do you think now who have been taken wish they weren't born so beautiful? You know, their whole life basically is ruined now because of that. And so, but Esther stands apart from them all. But as we get through this and start to really focus on Esther, we find that she has a whole lot more going for her than just her beauty. Like, her beauty is outward and inward. And that's one of the things we can take as we look and think about Esther and what we can learn, all of us, is that the inner man is always more important than the outer man. And in this society, when women are objectified and looked at in ways they shouldn't, you know, that has an impact on young women and how they think and even view themselves. And it's sad to me to see that there's so many women who buy into this, the attitude that society has on women, and they feed into it by how they dress, how they behave and act, and so on. And that's a sad consequence of that. And as Christians, again, you women, sisters who are Christians, you know, you can learn from Esther what kind of woman she was. We learn right here she was very, very beautiful. But her character went a lot deeper than that. And so we'll see some of that as we go through this. But her beauty was undeniable. And so it says at verse 8, and so when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put into the custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. And so she immediately gains favor. Now, as we read this, because we have studied it, who comes to your mind? Huh? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Joseph is one. And we have a few who gain favor, end up in foreign territory, but they gain favor with those in authority. And certainly Joseph gained the favor of Potiphar and then the jailer and then finally Pharaoh himself. And even Daniel, you remember, I guess we studied that on Thursday morning, but he gained favor in Babylon as well. And so now Esther comes along and we're going to see she kind of follows that same path. And in fact, later on, it's going to say that she basically gained favor with everyone who saw her. And again, you think outer beauty, and no doubt that is some of it, but it's deeper than that with her. Like, she gained with everyone that knew her. She gained favor with all, it will say. And not just men, but with all. And so there's something about personality involved in that, and says a whole lot about this woman, Esther. But she gains the favor of Hegai, and so he immediately begins to treat her in a special way. They all received their other women to help them. They were kind of like servants that would help these young virgins, and then put her in the best part of the house of women there, all because gained his favor. And it says now, verse 10, Esther had not made known her people or kindred. Why not? For Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And so they both of them had sort of covered up their identity. They're not known as Jews. And, you know, that gives some people some problems, and we don't, there's not a whole lot made about that. And so, you know, we don't have to say a whole lot about that, but it is true. And now a lot of this, we see the providence of God playing out, Because what do you think would have happened if it was known that Esther was a Jew? You think she would have been advanced like she ends up being? Even with a he guy. Think she would have gained favor? There was a lot of anti-Semitism, and so we see that probably there was a reason why they hid their identity. Whether they should have or not, you know, that's debatable. And now, but remember, again, I don't know how far I want to get into all of this, but you remember, these are individuals who have decided to stay in this foreign land. The first group has already been taken under Zerubbabel. 50,000 Jews have already gone back home. They've decided to stay. You've heard sermons on that before. Why didn't all the Jews go back home? You know? They got comfortable where they were. The Babylonians weren't all that nice to the Jews, really, overall. But we're told that the Persians treated them pretty good. They were even, we're going to find later, that Mordecai even rises to an official position. Maybe because Esther becomes queen, but whatever the case is, they were pretty good to the Jews. And so, you know, whenever the edict came out from Cyrus to let the Jews go back home, only 50,000 went of all of the Jews. And the rest of them stayed, including Mordecai and Esther. And so some people think that, you know, some of that was, you know, there had to be a reason why they kept their identity a secret. And Mordecai, you know, he commanded Esther, don't let them know that you are a Jewess. But the point here is, again, there's different reasons why some, according to scholars, why they might have done that. But the important thing here is, she obeyed. Who was Mordecai to her? They were cousins. But who was he really? Figure-wise. Right. That was her father. He had taken her in evidently at a young age and raised her. She was brought up by him. And she viewed him. I mean, she knew that. I mean, that was her cousin. But he evidently was older enough to where she viewed him as her father, and she obeyed him. He said, don't say anything. She wouldn't say anything. She did. Even when she became queen, she continued to obey the instructions of Mordecai. And so right away, you start to get a picture of this woman, Esther. Like, the idea of being obedient to your parents, to your mother and father, I mean, the Bible has a lot to say about that. And it says something about her. So, someone read Proverbs 1, verse 8 and 9. Go over there and read that passage. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. All right, very good. And I mean, that's just, I mean, you can just look at the references that would be attached to that verse. And I mean, there's all kind of instruction, particularly in the book of Proverbs, books like that show the wisdom in listening to your mother and father and following their instructions. And that was Esther. That's what she did. And you notice just the idea here of not telling anything. I mean, she kept quiet. She was wise enough to be able to keep a secret. How many people can keep a secret? But she did. Jesse, read Proverbs 11:13. Proverbs 11:13. All right, very good. So again, do the same thing. Look at some references that attach the idea of controlling the tongue and being able to keep a secret and you know all the passages on being a busybody or gossip, that sort of thing. It's all very unwise, not good character. But when it comes down to Esther, she wasn't a blabber. She wasn't one who went, you know, talked too much. What we begin to get a picture of is a woman, yeah, she has unmatchable beauty, but she's humble, submissive, quiet. She doesn't spread things. That's the kind of woman that she was. And it could be, we're not specifically told, but why she gained favor with all. Personality. Like, beauty only takes you so far, doesn't it? And so you gotta be careful how you say things these days, but particularly with the same sex. Like, you know, beauty might blind all men when you're one of the four most beautiful women on earth. I guess, I don't know how they came up with that again. But anyway, she had this remarkable beauty, and that might gain favor with most men, but it says all. And so even among women, she was one who gained favor. That had to have to do with character and personality and, you know, humility and that sort of thing. Not talking too much and over talking and just a godliness about her. And that's what all women should strive to be. So, yeah, go ahead. Right, right.
So to recognize that, to have
humility, to know it's not for our own glory or, you know, satisfaction, right, or our own desires, but to fulfill His plan. Right. Sure. Use the gifts that God has given you, and
really,
she did that, and so did Mordecai. You know, they are in a unique position here, but they took advantage. A lot of it is providential. And, you know, we say all the time, in life, sometimes there's chance in life. Sometimes things just happen. Sometimes you happen to be at the right place at the right time in life. Like, you know, I've heard people say, I wish I was born 50 years ago or, you know, 100 years ago or whatever. You know, they get to thinking about how things were at one particular time or, you know, whatever. I was born, you know, too late, 100 years too late or whatever. And there were a lot of things have to do with where, like, you think of how blessed we are to be born in this country. What did you have to do with that? Nothing. And so a lot of things in life are like that. And certainly, there's certain things with Esther and Mordecai that they're just in the right time at the right place, but a whole lot that is going on is providential. And because God knows the end from the beginning. And they're in all of these situations because of what's going to begin to transpire in chapter 3. We start to see the plot unfolding that is going to lead or that could potentially lead to the destruction of the Jews, which God cannot allow to happen. And so, but these individuals, the ones, the personalities involved in the story, don't know. You know, they're not all of that. They're not thinking of. And you know, they may know some things, but you know, things are happening in their life providentially, and you just like the rest of us. Providence is hard to put your finger on. When something is providential and happening providentially. But the lesson for us is God does work in our life. I'm not going to take the position, as some do, that every little part and portion of our life has been pre-planned and prepared by God. I don't see any Bible for that. But God's hand does play a part in our life. And you know, one of the great lessons from Esther, as we really get into this, is the sovereignty of God, kind of like portions of the book of Daniel. It is one of the most comforting subjects, I think, even though we may not completely understand it and there's some mysteries involved in God's sovereignty. The fact of the matter is, His sovereignty is one of the most comforting facts that we know of. That God is always on His throne and He's always in charge. Even when things are developing and you can't understand the why of it. Even with the choosing of all these women and taking them from their home and putting them in a harem and all of that. Has God lost control? No, He's firmly in charge and knows what He's doing. And so we see that playing out in the book of Esther as we go forward. So Esther has not made known to her people, her kindred, for Mordecai has commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spice and ointment for women, when the young women went into the king. And like you read all of that, and it's all ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's all an exaggeration. I mean, this is just the king. It's just amazing. So the women, in order to go into the king, have to be beautified for all that period of time, for a year, before they're worthy to be in the presence of this king. Like, really? That just, it says a whole lot about this king and about the attitude that men had towards women. But they all had to go through that. And so when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So whether it's jewelry or the kind of attire, she had, you know, many choices. Whatever she thought would give her the best chance of pleasing the king, she was given. And then in the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in the custody of Sheashkaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So, I mean, you just think about this. Just a terrible situation. And what a lustful king this is. To, like, every night he'd have one of these virgins come in and have relations with them. The next morning, send them to the concubines. The next night, another one. And, you know, it's amazing. And again, once you were sent off to the house of the concubines, unless he called you back, that's where you would stay. And that's just what was going on. Well, it says at verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now, again, she, very wise. Like, you know, Hegai would have some insight into what pleased the king. And, you know, he, you know, for who knows how long had been in charge of the women of this harem. And so she didn't take any extra. Her beauty was such, she didn't have to worry about all of that. But whatever he said, she just took his advice, and that's what she did. That's a sign of wisdom, isn't it? How many people won't listen to those who might know better? We're too prideful. Someone with this remarkable beauty would even consider, just be that humble, just to say, you know, whatever you say, that's what I'll do. And that's what she did. She didn't have any of the extras or anything like that. Just whatever he advised her to take, that's what she did. Now, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And what do you think that meant? That's as well put as anything. He didn't love her, love her. I think it's the NIV who said that he was attracted to her more than all the women. It wasn't real love. And he's just seen her, and then he's going to carry on even after this. Like, you think now from this point on he's devoted completely and only to her? Come on. Of course not. And so it isn't real love here. But she gains his favor, enough so to where she's not sent to the house of the concubines. Instead, it says the king loved her more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then what do you think he does next? Then the king gave what? A great feast. Because every opportunity he can have to throw a feast, he's going to do it. That's who he is. So he has a great feast for all of the officials, servants. It was Esther's feast. And he also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. And so, again, you get a little insight into that king. If he got mad, it was explosive. If he was happy with you, whatever, it was just, everything was over the top with this king. But Vashti becomes queen. And again, all of this providential and is leading to the salvation of the Jewish people. And so as we get into, there's one more section in chapter 2 that's, again, very providential, but it won't, I think, until chapter 6, the full value of it won't come out until chapter 6. But we see Mordecai discovering a plot against the king, and he's going to expose it. So we'll pick up there next week. I think that was the second bell. So.